Members, it's 8 a.m. I'll call the Committee on Taxes to order. And today we, you can tell by the packed house, we have the very popular Department Policy and Technical Bill, House File 2169. We do not have a quorum, so we're not going to put it in the motion quite yet, but we're going to start the testimony. But members, here's how I would like this to work. If it's okay with members, is that today we're just going to lay over this bill for possible inclusion. But at some time down the road, this bill more than likely will wind up on the general register. So as we go through it, indicate concerns that you have today, and then if it does end up going to the general register, we will deal with those parts that might be controversial. One thing we don't want to do here would ever pass out a technical bill that members had concerns with. And so just be ready to log those today as we go. And then also with each of the presenters, they'll cover either one or more articles. And when each presenter is complete, then feel free to ask questions. So we'll kind of take topics by topics, if you will. So welcome to the department this morning. Appreciate you being here. And we're going to start out with Ms. Bears is going to lead things off. And I need to take off here quickly for a bill. So I'm going to turn this over to the vice chair. So please proceed and welcome.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Joanna Bears, and I'm the Legislative Director for the Minnesota Department of Revenue. Thank you for the opportunity to present and discuss our 2019 Department of Revenue's Policy and Technical Bill. And a special thank you to Chair Marquardt for carrying this bill and all to the members who signed on to this bill. At the department, one of our key strategies is to listen to our customers and identify and develop improvements to the revenue system. While working with our customers, we often notice items in the tax code that could be clarified, updated, or corrected. Those items are what make up today's technical and policy bill. Some of the changes may seem small, but they are important and necessary to help improve the clarity and effectiveness of the tax code. As always, if you have questions or issues arise, we would appreciate the opportunity to work with you to find solutions or answer your questions. Again, thank you for this opportunity to present and discuss our bill today. With that, I will turn it over to our attorneys who will walk through the provisions of the bill, starting with Article 1.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jeremy Iden. I'm an attorney with the Minnesota Department of Revenue. I'll be going over Articles 1 and 2. Article 1 are the policy changes for the individual income and corporate franchise taxes. Sections 1, 3, and 4 are to ensure that the rate brackets and the Social Security subtraction, is the married filing separate, is exactly half of the married filing joint. Sections 2 and 3 amend the accelerated recognition of gain provisions to ensure that that provision follows the same allocation for non-residents as every other tax and credit. Article 2 is the individual income and corporate franchise tax technical provisions. Section 1 is to make clear that federal settlements under IRC 7121 and 7122 need to be reported to the Commissioner of Revenue. Section 2 deletes an obsolete reference to the payments to racehorse license holders. And Section 3 allows the Commissioner to have taxpayers designate the beneficiary for the first-time homebuyer accounts when they file the return. Right now, it's hard-coded to be April 15th, which means if a taxpayer designates a beneficiary and they are filing on an extension, that would not be allowed. This would allow that. And that concludes Article 2.
Any questions for Mr. Iden? Hearing none. Next. Ms. Tate. Welcome. Please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Melissa Tape, an attorney with the Minnesota Department of Revenue. Mr. Chair and members, I will be covering Article 3 of the department's bill, which deals with the partnership tax. As a general overview, this article addresses changes in federal law that were made as part of the Bipartisan Budget Act of 2015. As a result, the Minnesota statutes for reporting adjustments to federal taxable income require amendments to account for the new federal laws regarding partnership audits, particularly the new federal processing of and issuing of tax orders at the partnership or entity level rather than at the partner level. Some sections in Minnesota law will be recodified, but there will be no substantive changes to the way Minnesota administers its law in those instances. These reporting requirement sections are for general federal audit assessments, amended returns, and refund claims. The main focus of the proposed language addresses adjustments resulting from the new federal centralized partnership audit regime. Minnesota ordinarily imposes filing and payment requirements on tax-paying partners when they have either filed an amended return or received an assessment of tax from the IRS. But federal tax on partnership audit adjustments may now be assessed and paid without the taxpaying partners filing amended returns or receiving assessments. Therefore, Minnesota needs additional authority as well as a process for assessing state taxes on federal partnership audit adjustments. This is accomplished through the proposed language by adding a new statute section providing the requirement that taxpayers report federal adjustments at the partnership level. The proposal requires partnerships to pay the same Minnesota tax following a federal audit adjustment that each partner would have paid had they correctly reported their tax liability on their originally filed return. With that, I will take you through the components of Article 3. Sections 1 through 4 and 10 through 15 make various conforming changes to correct cross-references to the Revenue Agents Report, or RAR, statute throughout the administrative chapter and the changes in other sections. In Section 5, you will notice that there are 20 new definitions added as part of this article. These definitions are codified in a new section that is in front of the statute RAR, the state RAR statute, as they relate primarily to the new partnership adjustments. But there are some general definitions, including those that relate to the reporting of general liabilities following adjustments by the Internal Revenue Service. Primarily, the new definitions relate to specific types of partners and specific types of partnerships, and those definitions are to facilitate a statute that contemplates reporting for complex tiered partnership structures. Section 6 is the beginning of the more substantive provisions of this article. If you would like to follow along, Section 6 begins at page 15, line 18 in the legislation and on page 2 of the summary. This portion of the article replaces what is currently in Minnesota statute, which is the general requirement that taxpayers report an adjustment by the Internal Revenue Service to the state of Minnesota. The wording is a little bit new due to the newly defined terms included in Section 5 of this article. This is not substantively different than current Minnesota law. Same time frame, same reporting requirement. The last paragraph in that section provides an exception to the general reporting requirement. That exception is for partnerships that have partnership level audits that I mentioned earlier. With that said, we move to Section 7, which is for those partnerships with federal partnership level audit adjustments. Section 7 codifies a new section and begins at page 16, line 5 in the legislation and on page 2 of the summary. There is a contemplated state partnership representative who is able to make decisions that are binding on the partnership as to state tax matters. This is generally going to be the same person as the federal partnership representative, though taxpayers will be able to name a different state partnership representative if they wish. The next two subdivisions get to the substantive reporting requirements for partnerships with entity-level federal adjustments. There's basically a two-track system consisting of a default and then an option. The default is that partnerships will continue to be required to do what they already are required to do under current Minnesota law, which is when there's an adjustment made at the federal level, they will report those changes within 180 days to their direct partners. Within 90 days, they will also file amended composite tax income tax returns. The default system is if the partnership receives a federal assessment, it will act as an information reporting conduit that is similar to the way partnership law has operated in the state to date. The second track is an election that the partnership is allowed to make at the state level under Subdivision 3, which starts at page 17, line 10. If the partnership makes an election to pay the liability at the partnership level, they will file a federal adjustments report within 90 days with the Commissioner of Revenue, and after 180 days, they will go through a calculation where they will determine how much liability the partner should owe at the state level. What you'll see as part of the amendment is that there is an exemption here where you're not allowed to make the election if you're reporting an adjustment that's made after the administrative adjustment request or if you have a unitary corporate partner. That is because there are concerns that about the way that apportionment would work in those situations that might be opening up a planning opportunity for people to use the election. So in those two areas, the election is not allowed. The fourth subdivision, starting at page 18, line 17, provides that for each partnership entity that is in a tiered structure, if the top partnership tier chooses not to make the election and they act as an information reporting conduit by sending information to the next tier, the second partnership down the line can still make the election to pay at the entity level. We want to make sure that this is possible because in each tier, partnership management may decide that they would like to utilize the election to ease administrative burden. Each time you go down one of the tiers, it requires information reporting both to the state and to the individual partners. And then each of those individual partners has a filing obligation following that. The last couple of discussion points relate to the RAR statutes of limitations, both on assessments and for refund claims. There are two extensions. The first, found in Section 8, beginning at page 19, line 20 in the legislation and on page 2 of the summary, is a recodification of existing Minnesota law that extends the statute of limitations on assessment when there has been an RAR change that is timely reported within the 180-day period by a taxpayer. The statute of limitations on assessment at the state level is open for all state audit issues. The second, found in Section 9, beginning at page 20, line 13, in the legislation and on page 2 of the summary, is a recodification of existing Minnesota law for the statute of limitations on refund claims related to federal RAR adjustments. Lastly, Section 16 repeals subdivisions 7, 8, and 9 of Section 289 Cap A 38, as those subdivisions are recodified as discussed earlier. The provisions in this article are effective retroactively to account for both those partnerships that are required to pay federal assessments at the partnership level, which became effective for taxable years beginning after December 31, 2017, as well as those partnerships that made an early opt-in election to be assessed at the partnership level before the general federal effective date of taxable years beginning after December 31, 2017. Thank you, Mr. Vice Chair. This concludes Article 3.
Thank you, Ms. Tate. Before we take questions, we do have quorum. Has anybody had a chance to look at the minutes?
Make a motion to move the minutes.
Mr. Brand makes a motion to move the minutes of Wednesday, March 13th. Discussion? Hearing none. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carried. Questions for Ms. Tate? Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, this is my first time on Tax Committee this year, and I'm confused by the summary and the revenue, the note, the explanation of the bill, and the effect on the general fund. So can the testifiers, if they could go to pages 4, at the top of the page, section 2, it seems to me that we're going to be defining the vaping products, in essence, is what this is targeted at. And is that then going to expose them to the tobacco tax, or what's going on in that section two?
Ms. Bears. Oh,
Mr. Chair, Representative Fabian, we haven't described that part of the provision or part of the article yet. I think that's coming up next. She just went through the Article 3 for the partnership. Okay. So when we get to the nicotine solution products article, well, hopefully that'll answer your question.
Okay.
Representative Fagan?
Mr. Chair, well, the reason I bring it up now is because the explanation on the one page on the there's no impact. There's no fiscal impact. And it would seem to me that, and we can get the explanation when you get there, but it would seem to me that there will be a fiscal impact and that there will be more sales tax on tobacco collected. But I'll be interested to hear your answer.
Thank you. Representative Carlson. Representative Fabian, was that a question you wanted to learn to answer?
I'm sorry, I wasn't.
Well, I just raised my hand to be recognized, but I wasn't sure if you were done. Oh, I'm done.
You're done. Yep. Representative Carlson.
Mr. Chairman, I have these habits of reading fiscal notes and revenue notes and so on, and I see a line here that leaves me a little bit confused as to what the meaning is. It says, when we're talking about the various articles, one of the notes here, over time, the net impact should be zero. And what I'm wondering about is what you mean by over time. In ways and means, and I assume here in Texas, we watch changes that take place over time. And we usually have to build some of those numbers into the budget. Unless that window is relatively small. So that's my question, what you mean by over time.
Ms. Bears?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I don't know. I will have to come back with the definition of over time. I do know this policy provision is something that would this policy provision is what the net tax result would be the same under current law. So I'm not quite sure what the overtime is, but I can follow up with you when they for a specific time frame.
Representative Carlson.
Chairman, that would be fine. You know, if overtime just means
most of it married together for a year might be
or overtime means that it gets it into the second year of the biennium or even into an out biennium, and that has a totally different meaning relative to the fiscal impact. So if you can get that, that should be fine.
Thank you. Any other questions for Representative Erickson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm wondering, just to understand this Article 3 better, is this primarily dealing with audits?
Ms. Tate.
This article deals with audits, but also it deals with general assessments as well as refund claims.
So, Mr. Chair.
Representative Erickson.
Thank you. So can you give me an example or give us an example of the state partnership representative that's noted in line 16.6?
Ms. Tate.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative. The state partnership representative is the person that the partnership delegates to act as the voice for the entire partnership. It's generally would be a member, it could be a CPA, it could be someone along those lines.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That was very helpful. Thank you.
Mr. Williams may be able to address that. Representative Carlson's question.
Mr. Chair and Representative Carlson, so I think the provision that it indicates here that the net impact should be zero relates to the rounding of brackets. So essentially right now in law, the bracket amounts have to end and be rounded to the nearest $10. So that results in some cases that the brackets for married couples filing separate returns are not exactly half of the brackets for married couples filing joint returns. So my understanding of that provision is that essentially the bracket widths for married couples filing separate returns can now end at $5 and will be exactly half the bracket widths for married couples filing joint returns. I think on the over time, depending on how the rounding works, that might result in small changes one way or another, but the net effect should be zero. I think that's how I understand that provision.
Representative Carlson.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. I had read the reference to the rounding And I wasn't sure what the fiscal impact of that would be across the taxpayers. But my concern was in the revenue note, though, that it said over time there would be no fiscal impact. And it seemed to me when you were changing, even though that sounds like a modest number, $5, when you figure all taxpayers, that could accumulate to a significant number. And I assume they mean it'll be a wash at some point, but I was just interested in what the overtime meant. We'll explore that later, but that's helpful with your comments. Thank you.
All right. Any other questions for Ms. Tate? Hearing none, thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Hayner, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Nate Hayner, and I'm a staff attorney at the Minnesota Department of Revenue. And I'll be walking you through Article 4, which are the sales and use tax provisions, and these are all technical in nature. Section 1 amends current law to clarify an ambiguity created by the 2000 recodification of Chapter 297A for a sales tax exemption for repair and replacement parts and lubricants for ships used in interstate commerce and vessels of at least 3,000 gross tons. Sections 2, 3, and 4 amend various provisions in current law to clarify that the Department of Employment and Economic Development is the state agency responsible for certifying qualified data centers, greater Minnesota businesses, and biopharmaceutical manufacturing facilities, which the Department of Revenue can then rely upon to process refunds for sales tax exempt purchases these types of taxpayers are allowed to claim. Section 5 amends current law related to a sales taxpayer record-keeping requirement previously codified in a different section that was repealed in 1990 during the Chapter 289A recodification and inadvertently not reenacted in either Chapter 289A or 297A. And that concludes Article 4.
Thank you. Any questions? Ms. Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Hayner, Section 3, dealing with deed certification of greater Minnesota businesses, has there been a lack of accountability going on? Is that why you're making these technical changes to provide for the verification that these are qualifying businesses? Have we had an issue? Is that why you're making this change?
Mr. Hayner?
Mr. Chair, Representative, no, there isn't a lack of accountability. We just want to be very clear on what role deed takes in these particular certifications and what role the department takes, because these are in the sales tax statutes. Yes. But it puts a burden on the Department of Employment and Economic Development, and we just want to make sure that they know that we're not doing anything to determine whether or not a particular business qualifies as a greater Minnesota business.
Representative Erickson.
I'll think about this. Thank you.
Okay. Chair Davids.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm looking at Section 2, and I kind of become interested anytime we talk about data centers. I think it's the 2011 tax bill, the smoking hot tax bill. We put in the incentives to bring data centers to Minnesota. It's been wildly successful. I just want to make sure this part is just simply a technical change and doesn't do anything to stop data centers or go retroactive and do things there. Because the reason I like data centers so much is because you build them here, they generate a lot of heat, and you open up the windows and it cools them down. It's very inexpensive to do that. Since global warming has not affected Minnesota, they still want to come here to build their data centers because of the cold. And so I just want to make sure we're not, and I don't recall if that's in the governor's proposal to mess that all up, or if this messes it all up.
Mr. Hayner, is there anything more than a technical change here regarding the data centers?
Mr. Chair, Representative Davids, no, it's just a technical change. It doesn't change the exemption at all. It just says, deed, you're responsible for certifying a data center as qualified.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Very good. Please proceed. Or are we?
That concludes Article 4.
Okay. Oh, I'm sorry, Representative Fabian.
Well, Mr. Chair, and when you were out, I said this is my first go-around tax committee. Is someone here from deed to testify on this? I mean, is this something that they want to do, or is it just the revenue telling deed that this is what you're going to do?
great question. So, Mr. Hainer, have you talked with Deed on this provision?
Mr. Chair, Representative, yes, this was in the omnibus tax bill last year, and before we even proposed last year's legislation, which is exactly the same as this one, we contacted our counterparts at Deed, and they were on board with it and didn't have any issues with it.
Mr. Chair.
Chair Davis.
I think that provision in Section 2 is the reason they don't review the bill.
Didn't understand.
Very good. Anything else for Mr. Hainer? All right. Thank you very much. All right. Article 5. Please state your name.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Joshua Sandy, and I'm an attorney at the Department of Revenue. I'll be walking through Article 5 related to tobacco taxes and Article 6 related to Minnesota care taxes. I'll start with Article 5, in which there are three sections of proposed amendments related to vapor products. Section 1 specifically places the term nicotine solution products, which will include vapor products by definition, within the definition of tobacco products. While the department's position has been that vapor products containing nicotine derived from tobacco plants already fits within the current definition of tobacco products, the purpose of this proposal is to make that extremely clear. Section 2 adds subdivision 22B to section 297F.01 to define the term nicotine solution products. The reason we are using the term nicotine solution products instead of vapor products is because some authorities refer to these products as producing an aerosol instead of a vapor. These authorities include the Surgeon General and the Center for Disease Control. The department believes the best approach is to use the term nicotine solution products, which will by definition include nicotine products that produce a vapor or an aerosol. Clause B defines nicotine solution products to also include products that contain nicotine derived from other sources besides tobacco plants, and that would start January 1st, 2020. The reason for this proposal is because the department is aware that there are labs creating nicotine chemically without deriving it from tobacco plants. In addition, we do know that tobacco can be derived from plants other than tobacco. We are not aware of any of this being used in the state of Minnesota at this point, but we anticipate that when it's cost-effective, lab-created nicotine could be. Clause 3 provides that the term nicotine solution products includes the devices and accessories sold with and meant to be used in the consumption of solutions containing nicotine. And Section 3 amends the definition of wholesale sale price to provide that the wholesale sale price of nicotine solution products does not include accessories sold with vapor kits if the distributor sells the solution containing nicotine separately and can isolate the cost of the solution containing nicotine. This is consistent with what is already reflected in Revenue Notice number 12-10 published by the Department of Revenue. And that concludes Article 5.
Mr. Sandy, I'll have you do Article 6 then.
Okay. Article 6 is regarding the Minnesota Care Tax technical provisions. These are related to the provider taxes, the wholesale drug distributor tax, and the legend drug use tax. Sections 1, 4, 8, and 10 are changes being proposed to amend the definition of wholesale drug distributor in Chapter 295, as well as add three additional definitions to Chapter 295. And this is due to the Pharmacy Board's legislative proposals in House File 1718 and Senate File 2169. And those proposals put forward by the Pharmacy Board are meant to conform with some federal licensing requirements. The Pharmacy Board's proposals will, among other things, repeal the defined term wholesale drug distributor from the pharmacy chapter in Section 151.44. As a result, the Pharmacy Board will no longer be defining the term or licensing entities as wholesale drug distributors. Under current law, Chapter 295 defines a wholesale drug distributor as a wholesale drug distributor required to be licensed under the pharmacy chapter. Since the Pharmacy Board will no longer use the term wholesale drug distributor in its licensing, the department proposes in Section 8 to amend the definition of wholesale drug distributor in Chapter 295 by inserting language similar to what the pharmacy chapter's current definition of wholesale drug distributor is. The purpose of this amendment is to make sure that the wholesale drug distributor tax continues applied to the same tax base as it does today. Otherwise, the tax base could be diminished or potentially eliminated. Section 10 adds a definition for wholesale distribution. The reason that this term is being added to Chapter 295 is because the proposed definition of wholesale drug distributor includes a reference to wholesale drug distribution. Section 1 adds a definition for emergency medical reasons, which is a term that is referenced in the definition of wholesale drug distribution. And Section 4 adds a definition for manufacturer, which is also a term referenced in the definition of wholesale drug distribution. Sections 2 and 9 are related to two proposed amendments to Section 295.50, Subdivision 3. The first is to replace the term staff model health carrier in Clause 3 with staff model health plan company. The term staff model health carrier was amended to staff model health plan company in 1994, and the use of staff model health carrier in Clause 3 predates that amendment. So we are updating the term in Clause 3 so that it's consistently used the same throughout the rest of the chapter, or as it is consistently used throughout the rest of Chapter 295. The second proposed amendment removes language related to the term legend drug from the definition of gross revenues and places it in the definition of legend drug. Because the language is talking about legend drugs, the department believes it fits better in the definition of legend drug. Section 3 makes three proposed amendments to Section 295.50, Subdivision 4. The first amendment adds paragraph A6 to clarify that the definition of healthcare provider includes entities that employ or contract with a healthcare provider to provide, supervise, oversee, or consult regarding patient services. The second proposed amendment is located in paragraph B2 to clarify that home care providers required to be licensed under Chapter 144A are not healthcare providers as long as the home care services they provide are pursuant to Chapter 144A. The third change is to a statutory reference in paragraph B5 in order to conform with proposed changes to Section 295.53 regarding exclusions and exemptions, and I will talk about those here shortly. Section 5 amends Section 295.50, Subdivision 9B, paragraph B4, to clarify which community support programs and family community support programs are not included in patient services. This will make it easier for taxpayers to know exactly what support programs are not considered patient services and is consistent with the department's revenue notice number 06-13. Sections 6, 7, and 13 are a reorganization of Section 295.582, Subdivision 1. In its current format, there are some very long paragraphs, and it can be difficult to read. This proposal breaks the paragraphs up into shorter paragraphs and clauses, and as part of the reorganization, we also move some definitions in this section over to the definitions portion of the chapter, which is 295.50. Sections 11 and 12 amend Section 295.53 to clarify which clauses are exclusions and exemptions for ease of tax administration. This proposal also clarifies that payments received under the Medicare Advantage program are exempt, as well as federal TRICARE sourced funds. It also deletes unnecessary language regarding nutritional products and blood components, since those are already excluded from being legend drugs. Excuse me. It also deletes a reference to a repealed statute. And finally, it amends Section 295.57, Subdivision 5, to conform with the reorganization of the exclusions and exemptions section. And that concludes Article 6.
Hey, before I take questions, I'd like to officially move House File 2169 for possible inclusion into the tax omnibus bill. Any questions? Representative Carlson.
Mr. Chairman, when you talked about the changes with the wholesale drug distributor, I don't know if you're familiar with House File 400, which will be on the House floor on Monday, dealing with the opioid crisis. And that bill is essentially being funded by what I call at least the licensure provision. It raises about $20 million. That you may have read last biennium, they talked about a penny a pill, and this bill now changes it to increasing the fees or license fees instead of the penny the pill to fund the programs under the bill, House File 400. I don't know if you've looked at that or if any of those changes impact on that, either positively or negatively. But I think it's something that we should make sure it doesn't have an impact on. Perhaps you'd have an answer now, but if you don't, we can find out later.
Mr. Sandy?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I am not aware if it does or not. I could defer to Ms. Bayers to see if she has any additional information. Otherwise, I'd be happy to get back to you on that.
Ms. Bayers?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I would have to look at the bill again, and we can follow up with you.
Thank you.
Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Sandy. Is that correct? Thank you.
Correct, yes.
I appreciate the edits that you make whenever you make statute more readable for our constituents and for us. I really appreciate that. But I have a question about Section 11. I noticed that, this is...
Erickson, what page number is that?
Oh, I'm on page 39, actually, okay. With the new language under paragraph B.
Okay.
My question, Mr. Sandy, is this is effective the day following the signature, the final enactment. So are these hospitals and other providers going to be able to reset their programs so they know that these are now exempted from the gross revenues that they file?
Mr. Chair, Representative, these are already exempt. It's more of a reorganization of the statute to make it more organized. So I believe, while I haven't checked with the providers, I believe it would not affect that at all.
Excellent, and thank you for reorganizing. That's very good.
Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Mr. Sandy. My question was on Section 7, which starts at lines 36.13, and the definition of a third-party purchaser of health care services. For those of us who work a lot more on the health insurance end of things, we tend to define a third-party purchaser as the most common is an employer. Most people get their coverage through an employer. Under an ERISA plan, and it's the employer who actually does the purchasing and selection and those sorts of things rather than the patient. And the definition on 36.17 says that it pays for health care services on behalf of patients. Now, I can read the end of the line as otherwise insures patients as maybe referring to the employer, but I was wondering why we're using that language of on behalf of patients, since I think in most instances it's actually not the patient involved. They just enroll or don't enroll.
Mr. Sandy.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I would need to get back to you on that. This is language that was taken exactly from what was in current law, so I'm not exactly sure about that specific portion that you're referencing to, but I'd be happy to look into it and get back to you.
Thank
Representative
you.
Loeffler.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Any other questions for Representative Fabian?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. While you were out, I had a question about the revenue note. And the revenue note says there's zero impact. And then I was looking at Section 5 with the tobacco taxes. And there appears to me to be an expansion of sales tax collected for tobacco products now that fall into the vaping category. So my question is there an increase in revenue as a result of Section 6?
Mr. Sandy.
Mr. Chair, Representative, no, there should not be. These are already taxed under the tobacco tax, which is not a sales tax. It's a tax levied at the or imposed at the distributor level. So this would not affect sales taxes.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, but would it affect revenue to the state of Minnesota?
Mr. Sandy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative. It should not, because the tax is already being imposed, as this would be. This is just more of a clarification to make certain that vapor products are included in the definition of tobacco products, which was the intent of the changes in 2010. So this is just clarifying the law. It does not impact how the tax is administered.
Representative Babia.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So just an interesting point that raises in my mind, I mean, could somebody have then, because that wasn't clarified in the previous language and now you are clarifying it, was this subject to a lawsuit under the old system? And why are you making the change?
Mr. Sandy.
Mr. Chair, Representative, my understanding is there was some litigation before I was personally at the department that settled where there was a challenge to the definition. Again, the department's position is very clear that we do consider vapor products as tobacco products and subject to the tax. My understanding is there was some litigation regarding that.
Representative
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And what was the outcome of that litigation?
Mr. Sandy.
Mr. Chair, Representative, my understanding is it was a settlement, so the issue did not fully resolve.
Representative
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, that's one of the issues that I hear from folks is that revenue makes a decision about what to do, and they just go ahead and do it, and it runs into some obstacles once in a while. And I'm not making a value judgment on vaping or tobacco or whatever. Well, I am. I don't particularly care for tobacco, but I just think that the words expressed here, in that the revenue just decides what we're going to do and that's the way it's going to be, you know, based on language, and now they're recognizing that they probably weren't correct and we're making the correction, and I appreciate the correction, but I don't like kind of that heavy-handed attitude that some people feel that the Department of Revenue comes down on them with, but that's just a little editorial note. Thank you.
Anything else on these articles? If not, Mr. Sandy, thank you so much.
Thank you.
So we're going to move to Article 7. Ms. Griffin, welcome to the committee. If you'd please state your name and begin.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Chelsea Griffin, and I'm a staff attorney with the Minnesota Department of Revenue. I will be walking you through Articles 7 through 12 of the department's policy and technical bill. So we'll begin with Article 7, which is the property tax policy article of the bill. Section 1 requires the Department of Transportation to certify small cities assistance aid amounts to the Department of Revenue by June 1st of the payable year. Section 2 modifies language so that the spouse of a non-occupying property owner is not required to furnish a Social Security number for homestead application purposes. And Mr. Chair, that concludes Article 7. Article 8 is the property tax technical article of the bill. Section 1 clarifies that the Commissioner of Revenue may request property tax data at the parcel level or higher at the time and in the form and manner as the commissioner determines. This language reflects the implementation of the Property Record Information System of Minnesota, which is commonly known as PRISM, which is the department's current system for collecting property tax data. Sections 2 through 18 of Article 8 strike references to abstract level reports. Abstracts are no longer used under the PRISM system. In Section 19, the repealer strikes language that describes the abstract of tax lists. Again, the abstract of tax lists is no longer collected under the PRISM system. That concludes Article 8. Articles 9 through 12 contain a recodification of Chapter 69 of the Minnesota statutes. If you're unfamiliar with Chapter 69, it contains a confusing mixture of fire state aid, police state aid, insurance law, and pension program provisions. The most critical issues with this chapter are as follows. First, the language is out of date and does not accurately reflect technological advances that are leveraged by the department to administer the programs. For example, current law requires the commissioner to mail forms, but the department has used electronic forms for many years. Secondly, the language is difficult to comprehend in Chapter 69. For example, many provisions contain requirements for both police aid and fire state aid, which make it difficult to understand how the programs are separately administered. And thirdly, some provisions in Chapter 69 belong in other chapters of the Minnesota statute. So, for example, Minnesota Statute Section 69.80 is most appropriately placed in Chapter 424A. The recodification in front of you accomplishes the following. It separates fire state aid and police state aid into separate chapters of the Minnesota statutes, and other provisions are appropriately placed in other existing chapters of the Minnesota statutes.
Ms. Griffin, before you get into the recodification of that part, I want to go back to Article 8.
Oh, yes, Mr.
If I could, before you kind of head into that. And I had some concerns regarding the PRISM from some rural electric co-ops in gathering data and so forth. Are you aware of what concern that might be, or have you heard anything to that as far as collecting that data and how that might affect electric co-ops?
Mr. Chair, no, unfortunately, I'm not aware of what that issue may be, but we can certainly look into it and get back
okay.
to you.
Okay, so it might be an area of concern. So, okay, thank you. And maybe some of our public testifiers at the end may talk about that. So thank you very much. Please continue.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. So back to the description of the recodification. Again, it separates fire state aid and police state aid into separate chapters of the Minnesota statutes, and the other provisions are appropriately placed in existing chapters of the Minnesota statutes. The language is updated to reflect current procedures and accommodate technological changes. And the language is modernized, which makes it easier to understand and administer for all stakeholders. I want to emphasize that this is a technical recodification. There are no policy or administrative changes to the fire state aid, police state aid, or other provisions as a result of the recodifications or the recodification contained within these articles. Before the department began drafting this recodification, we put together a small group of subject matter experts to make sure that everything was covered appropriately. The folks that participated were from the Minnesota Department of Public Safety, specifically the State Fire Marshal's Office, provided staff to help us with the drafting. We had a pensions expert from the Office of the State Auditor, and we had a number of people from the Minnesota Department of Revenue, specifically the Special Taxes and Property Tax Divisions, that provided subject matter expertise to make sure that this recodification was completed in an accurate manner. I would also note that after a final draft was put together, the department did reach out to over a dozen entities and organizations for feedback on the language, and the feedback that we did receive from those entities and organizations is incorporated into the language that you have in front of you today. Mr. Chair, before I dive into the language, I am curious if you would like me to walk through the provisions of these articles section by section, or just provide a high-level overview of the articles.
Ms. Griffin, a high-level overview would be sufficient. So thank you very much.
You.
And if members, I know a number of the members have scrutinized this very closely, so if they do have extra questions, we may have to interrupt. But otherwise, just an overview.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I will note that a crosswalk table, I believe, was handed out to committee members this morning. That crosswalk table shows where the old law is, where the language from that, or I guess I should say the current law, so where that language is located in Chapter 69, where it is moving to in the recodification. And it has a very detailed analysis as to what each provision does and the description of each technical change that occurred as a result of the recodification. Article 9 creates a new Chapter 477B, which is where the fire state aid program provisions from Chapter 69 would reside if enacted into law. This chapter includes definitions that pertain to the fire state aid program, the eligibility criteria for a municipality or independent nonprofit firefighting corporation to qualify to receive fire state aid, the fire state aid calculation formula, and information on how fire state aid is apportioned and paid. The most significant technical changes to the language in this article occur in Section 1, which is the definitions section, and Section 4 regarding payments. The crosswalk table covers the changes in depth, but I will give you a brief description of those changes. In Section 1, six definitions were amended for clarity or to limit the definition in current law to the fire state aid program only, and four definitions were added to define terms that commonly occurred throughout the provisions of Chapter 69 but were left undefined in current law. In Section 4, the payments language, the language specifies that the Department of Revenue is to make the fire state aid payments. This reflects the long-time practice for administering the fire state aid payments. Current law describes an administration process that would involve the Minnesota management and budget, but this has not been the case for many, many years. Further, language was added to clarify that interest does not apply when a payment is withheld for noncompliance with the Office of State Auditor financial reporting requirements. This also reflects current practice. Section 6 is an uncodified provision that describes the purpose of the recodification as well as the mechanics of the effective dates. In Section 7, the repealer repeals the relevant provisions in Chapter 69 that are recodified in this article and Article 10. Article 10 creates a new Chapter 477C, which is where the police state aid program provisions from Chapter 69 would reside if the sections of this article are enacted into law. This chapter follows a similar pattern to that of the fire state aid chapter contained in Article 9, so definitions, eligibility criteria, the calculation formula, and payment process. As with the fire state aid program, the most significant technical changes to the police state aid chapter are contained in Section 1, which provides the definitions for the police state aid program, and Section 4 regarding payments. In Section 1, three definitions were amended to reflect the actual administration of the police state aid program, and one definition is added to address an undefined term in Chapter 69. In Section 4, language is updated, clarifying that the Minnesota Department of Revenue makes police state aid payments, and Minnesota management and budget is not involved. This is consistent with current administrative practice. Article 11 creates new provisions for language in Chapter 69 that belongs in other chapters of the Minnesota statutes and is not directly addressing the administration of either fire state aid or police state aid programs. Section 1 moves language describing how the fire and police premium reports are to be administered. The penalty amounts are also listed in this provision. The biggest technical change that occurred in this provision is that it reflects the department's use of technology. Current law describes a mailed form process, but the department now uses electronic forms to collect the information on these reports. Section 2 and 3 move language that pertains to the Office of the State Auditor. Section 2 describes the financial reporting requirements of relief associations to the Office of the State Auditor, and Section 3 moves provisions that describe authorized administrative expenses of a relief association. The repealer repeals language in Chapter 69 that is now recodified in the sections of this article. Further, it also repeals Section 69.33, which describes an obsolete insurance premium reporting process that is not administered by the commissioner or any other state agency. And finally, Article 12 is the article that's almost entirely comprised of necessary cross-reference updates that would need to occur if Articles 9 through 11 are enacted into law. I will point out, however, that the repealer repeals the Volunteer Retention Stipend Aid Pilot Program provision. This provision sunset for aid payable after calendar year 2017, which is now well past. The report required to the legislature on the program was due on or before January 15th of 2018. So accordingly, this language has been completely expired. And Mr. Chair, that provides you with my overview of the recodification articles.
Very good. Any questions for Ms. Griffin? All right. Thank you very much. Ms. Bears, what's next?
Mr. Chair, it's Article 13, the miscellaneous policy provision.
Very good. Good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, committee members. I'm Alex Bajwa, a staff attorney with the Minnesota Department of Revenue, and I'll be testifying regarding Articles 13 and 14, which are the miscellaneous provisions of the department's policy and technical bill. Beginning with Article 13, Sections 1, 2, and 3 prevent a business from evading a sales tax liability by prohibiting the issuance of a new sales tax permit to a business or person that has an unpaid sales tax liability not under appeal, provides for cancellation with notice, and expands the commissioner's authority to disclose data identifying the holder of a sales tax permit that has been canceled under these provisions. Section 4 provides that the local lodging tax is due on the entire consideration paid for access to the lodging, including ancillary or related services, as defined in general sales tax law. Section 5 provides that, for local governments that do not have the department administer this tax, the local ordinance may require annual remittance and filing of lodging taxes by accommodations intermediaries. the ordinance has this requirement, then the due date of the tax and return is October 20th of each year, and the local government must inform the accommodations intermediary of the due date and also provide them electronically the geographic and zip code information necessary to apply the tax. Section 6 repeals the department's requirement to report specific types of data to explore Minnesota tourism. The report is now developed through an interagency agreement and is no longer required to be referenced by statute. Moving on to Article 14, Sections 1 through 28 of Article 14 contemporize language in various statutes describing persons with a disability or persons who are blind, as well as language describing spouses as husband and wife. There are no administrative changes as a result of these updates. Sections 29, 30, and 31 of Article 14 adjust the distribution date for the net proceeds tax from July 15th of each year to December 15th. This adjustment addresses a looming issue because mining companies that will be subject to the net proceeds tax receive an automatic 7-month extension from the May 1st due date to file the return, which extends the due date to December 1st. This option is frequently utilized by mining companies filing their occupation tax return, and the department anticipates that mining companies subject to the net proceeds tax would do the same. This would render the current distribution date of July 15th unworkable. Finally, Section 32 updates a change to the tax court statute made in 2017 to now provide that all cases have 30 days to file post-trial motions, regardless of when the case was commenced. This matches the practice in district court civil cases. And that concludes Article 14.
Very good. Any questions? Yes, Representative Peters.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sorry to get ahead of you there. Just this isn't a question for the bill itself or the presentation. It's just that for future use, the bills are organized by page numbers and line numbers, and sometimes referencing just sections, it's harder to jump back and forth between this report and the other. And so my request, or at least consideration for you to consider, is when you reference the sections, if in the, especially in the updates that they have as summaries, if they would include the page number and the line number ahead of it, it's easy for us to cross-reference when we're jumping back and forth between things for the future. And if there's a range of numbers, just the first one is just fine. But it would just help us for something especially this large to review. So.
Representative Petersburg, thank you. Any other questions or Representative Fabian?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So in the bill, in section Article 13, page 110, talks about the local option sales tax. So in a practical sense, what is the net effect of this to, say, the motel owner and the city in which the tax is being applied?
Mr. Bodge?
In their day-to-day business operation.
Ms. Bears?
Mr. Chair? Mr. Fabian, Representative Fabian, what are you asking, like, what the percentage of?
Nope. I'm just asking in terms of what they have to do for reporting or whatever. What does this actually do to the day-to-day operation of the motel or the city, or it could be collected by the state? I read the language and I heard what you said, and it just, you know, quickly goes through it, but the actual impact on the business is what?
And Ms. Bears, we also have Pat Dalton has moved into position there too. It's just the case.
No.
But Ms. Bears is
being Mr. Elected. Chair, Representative Fabian, there is no impact. They should be already collecting this sales tax or this local tax.
Ms. Dalton, you want to add any light to this?
Mr. Chair, Representative Fabian, this has been an ongoing issue for several years on travel intermediaries, these online sales tax providers like Travelocity and things like that, mm-hmm. should have been collecting this tax, but local lodging taxes are not administered by the state except for a handful of them. There's like four. Mm-hmm. And so what's been going on is cities have been having to kind of sue different travel companies to get this collected. And so this was originally proposed as a way to clarify that, yes, indeed, they are under this obligation. And some of this language is also compromise language that was worked out between these travel intermediaries and the local cities, because one of the problems is then a travel intermediary may say, there's only one hotel in this city. I'm not going to bother filing monthly reports. So I'm just going to drop the hotel in the city from my site. So a lot of this language is related to if a city thinks that they will help keep their lodging on the travel website by going to annual reports, they have that option to go to annual reports instead of monthly reports. So this is compromise language that has actually been worked out over, I think, about 3 or 4 years.
Representative Fabian.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And to that point, then, I would say, I mean, do you anticipate that there is going to be a net increase in local lodging tax collected? Or, I mean, just like the Wayfair settlement decision?
So, Ms. Dalton, do you think there would be a revenue change either on the state or local levels, Ms. Dalton?
Mr. Chair, Representative Fabian, this won't have any impact on the state. But, yes, I think it could probably increase the amount of local lodging tax that is collected in some individual jurisdictions.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then just to be clear, what then is going to be the process for the city to get the money from the travel company?
Ms. Dalt?
Mr. Chair, Representative Fabian, as I said, under current law, they should be collecting and reporting and remitting on a monthly basis. But as I said, the travel agency, the travel intermediary said that's not practical to do for 853 cities where sometimes they only have like one hotel in that city. And so what they've, this compromise would be that they would file once a year with that city, and the city has to give them the information necessary so they know what lodging is actually subject to that local lodging tax.
Representative Fabian.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair.
No.
So how does the city go about finding out when this report is filed, where is that information stored, and how does the city, if there's revenue, how does the city get that revenue?
Ms. Stone.
Mr. Chair, Representative Fabian, local cities collect their own lodging tax. So this would be the travel intermediary would file with the city
okay. And
make the payment directly to the city.
And one last thing.
Representative Fabian.
So if, I mean, what's the enforcement here if they didn't? Do we call in revenue then? Or,
yeah.
You know, because as you said earlier, you know, they should be doing this. I'll remind or let the committee know that my wife says should is a value judgment. So,
Ms. Dalton.
Mr. Chair, Representative Fabian, I'd have to go back and actually look at what the enforcement mechanism is for the lodging tax. I don't know right off the top.
Chair Davis.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Dalton was talking about compromise language. Have both sides signed off on this language?
Ms. Dalton?
You said it four times. And I figure if there's a compromise on this, you're up for a Nobel Peace Prize.
Ms. Dalton.
Mr. Chair, Representative Davids, have the travel intermediaries all, you know, written down that, yes, they agree? I don't know that there was actually any formal agreement, but I do know in the discussions they were saying this would make it more palatable.
And just for members, we do have public testimony where I think some of this will be addressed.
Thank
so it
Mr.
sounds
Chair.
Like, in the words of a former chair, we might not have total peace in the valley on this issue. So any other questions? Representative Swazinski.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Mr. Chair,
sorry. Sorry. It was a late night last night. Anyway, no, just kind of a 74 we lost. And it's sad. Anyway, moving on, just from a question kind of along the lodging tax and how it would potentially affect Airbnbs and folks independently operating rental units out of their own home. Would this have any interconnection with that?
Ms. Dalton?
Mr. Chair, Representative Swadinsky, we're playing stump the analyst again today. This is actually a really interesting issue because technically Airbnbs and similar situations should be collecting local lodging taxes. I'm not sure that we have an enforcement mechanism right now. Other states have been working on developing statutes directly to deal with that, and that may be something that this legislature may have to look at long term. But there isn't. Right now, technically, they should be collecting. Whether they are or not is kind of a local issue.
So, yeah, so if we have more kind of specific things, we can get those.
Thank you.
Staff.
Well, let's I'm done. Yeah.
Okay, so very good. Because we can,
Mr. Chair, thank you. We
can get this to staff, and we can have some time to research and so forth. Some of this, I think, it's pretty technical and detailed. Well, I think this, Mr. Boshaw or Ms. Bears, anything more on this? Otherwise, I know we have some public testifiers that would like to come forward.
Mr. Chair, members, we just appreciate your time for hearing this bill today. And if there's any questions, please let us know.
So, very good. Thank you so much. So, at this time, we'll go to public testimony. We have Jill Larson, and then Tony Quillis is on deck.
Yeah, I'm just drinking stuff.
You're kidding.
Ms. Larson, welcome. Good morning. Please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. I am Jill Larson with the Minnesota Business Partnership. I wanted to flag one issue for you and the committee. This is concerning Article 3, Sections 8 and 9. The issue is that when the federal IRS audit adjustments or refund claims are filed with the Department of Revenue, the proposed language would limit taxpayers to filing a Minnesota refund claim only related to those federal adjustments, but the language doesn't similarly limit the department to assessments only related to those federal adjustments. And we think the policy should treat the taxpayer and the department equitably, with both parties being limited to the changes resulting from the federal adjustments. Speaking of peace in the valley, you might recall this was an issue last session that was also brought to the committee's attention, and we did work with the department and came up with language that was agreeable to both parties that essentially treated both parties the same. The federal adjustments are, you can assess it based on the federal adjustments, you can get a refund based on the federal adjustments. So we are hopeful that we can get that type of language into the bill as we move forward. I did mention to Ms. Mayers this morning our concern, and I think there is a meeting that's going to be scheduled to continue the discussion, but I did just want to flag it for the committee so you're aware of it. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Larson, that was Article 3. What section?
Sections 8 and 9 are the main concerns. Okay. And Mr. Chairman, if I might add, I know that the CPA Association also has concerns with this language, but I know that they are in another body right now in another bill, so I just wanted to add
just
that.
Wanted to make sure I had it properly marked in my program here. I'm keeping track of these. All right.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Yep, thanks very much, Ms. Larson. Mr. Aquilis, and then Shane Rudling is on deck. I saw Ms. Okay, very good. Welcome. Please state your name.
Hello, my name is Shane Rudling, and I represent the Bloomington Port Authority. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, for hearing us again on this issue. We're back this year again. And we'd like to thank the Department of Revenue and their technical and policy bill for addressing this issue again. So regarding local lodging tax, I will try to answer some of the questions that were raised here a few minutes ago, but also there's some other people here that can also answer them. So local lodging taxes are in place in a number of communities and state jurisdictions. Simply put, the current statute has a provision in there where the tax base for sales tax is not the same as the tax base for local lodging tax.
So Mr. Rudling, can you refer to article and sections? Okay, or do you have that in front of you? If not, that's fine, but it helped me a little bit.
Mr. Chair, page 110, I think.
So we're back to that. Page 110.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Yes, we're talking about Section 13, the local lodging tax.
Okay, Article 13 looks like Sections 4 and 5. Okay, very good.
Thank you. So the local lodging tax base varies depending on how the customer pays and who collects the tax. We just think this is incorrect tax policy. For example, if a person is booking a hotel room and they pay $100 for the room, the sales tax is clearly on $100. And the local lodging tax may be on a number below that. Just say it's $80, where the hotel keeps 80 of those dollars and the Expedia or Travelocity keeps 20 of those dollars. The local lodging tax in some situations, once again, depending on who collects the tax and how the room is booked, is only paid on the 80. And then that 20 is not remitted to the local tax collector. If you book that same room on Marriott.com, there's no question you'll pay tax on the 100, sales tax and local lodging tax. But if you book that room on Expedia.com, you may pay something different. The results are lower tax revenue for those jurisdictions, but that local lodging tax that's collected helps those BCVBs in those areas, the Convention and Visitors Bureaus, and it also creates an unfair playing field for the local Minnesota businesses who are following the rules, if you will, versus these online travel companies who often are foreign companies. If you look on the Secretary of State's website, they're incorporated out of the country and often don't have any Minnesota ties except for people that are here at the Capitol. You might hear that the tax is too complicated and it may impact wedding planners, etc. This is certainly not the intent of the law, nor do we think that is the effect of the current language. And that dealing with the various taxes in different jurisdictions is too complicated. Well, these are tech companies that deal with this all across the country. This has been fixed in a number of jurisdictions across the United States, and we think it's time to fix it now. And with that, I'll end my testimony, stand for questions, and pass it on to another testifier.
Thanks. Very good. Sir, you'd please state your name. And
thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Jim Sackman. I'm a hotelier in Bloomington. Have been there for most of my 35-year career. Can't believe it's been that long. I want to put a number to this issue, and I spent some additional time this week so you can understand what the magnitude is of the online travel agents, who, first of all, I must preface by saying that we like the hoteliers like the online travel community. It's a big, important part of our business. But like Shane said, I think it's important that they play fair. It's an equal playing field, and they pay tax like we do. I'm responsible for about 2.2% of our supply in the market. My hotel is 230-some rooms to a market that's 10,500 rooms. Last year, for all of 2018, we did 64,000 occupied rooms. Of that, we are probably a little bit below average in the sense where we use as little online travel agent rooms as possible, because obviously it's a bigger commission. We did about 4,600 rooms last year of that 64,000 from direct online travel agents like Expedia. Expedia, in fact, did the majority of those rooms, I think 2,800 of the 4,600 rooms. And like Shane said, when the person books a reservation, they have a choice to pay now or pay later. 85% of the people that booked through Expedia into our hotel chose to pay now. Because they chose to pay now, they paid Expedia directly for the room. So if the room was for sale for $150, they charge the guests $150 plus the appropriate tax. They send the reservation to us, net of their commission. So if $150, they have a $30 commission, the reservation gets sent to us at $120 plus tax. Okay, so they're keeping their commission, and they're keeping the tax on that commission. So it's not just under collecting, it's collecting, but under reporting or under transferring to the hotel. So we're just seeing the net rate. We don't know what the gross rate is, but because of rate parity, we can assume it's the rate that we are originally selling, and they're charging tax on that full amount, but the reservation we see is for that that lesser amount. Going back to our statistics for 2018, I calculated about $9,000 in just Expedia shortages $9,200. Again, I'm 2% of the market, so if you apply that to 100% of the market, that's well in excess of $400,000 one year. And thank you very much for the opportunity to speak.
Thank you very much. Any questions for either one of these testifiers? I know we have one more testifier, Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm sorry I raised this issue earlier, but no, I'm not.
No, you're not.
I'm not. So I'm curious, when you negotiate with one of these travel companies, if they have built this extra revenue into their negotiations with you, and we make this change, the next time they come back, are they going to try to renegotiate to make up for that instead of giving you 120 out of the 150? They're going to say, well, we'll give you 115 out of the 150.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Sabin.
There you go.
And I don't know the answer to that. The agreements are typically negotiated on a brand level.
Oh.
So in some ways that helps us because we have one contract. In other ways, it's frustrating because we have local differences that, you know, create these oddities. So,
Chair Davis.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and to Ms. Dalton's comments on compromise language. Who was the compromise with? The department compromised with the department? It doesn't sound like there's a compromise here.
Yeah, I think we might have another testifier coming, too, that may kind of get to that, okay, Chair Davis, if that's all right. So, all right. Thank you very much, gentlemen. Joel Carlson.
Mm-hmm. Tony Quillis has a witness who's going to stand in for him. I'll go after him.
Very good.
He was coordinating my presence. I'm Anna Thill, president at Visit Maine Cato. Thank you for the opportunity to speak to you all today.
Would you please state your last name again?
Thill, T-H-I-L-L.
Oh, Thill. Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome. So I represent Visit Maine Cato in Maine Cato. I'm also on the board of the Minnesota Association of Convention and Visitors Bureaus. And as a representative of both entities, we are supportive of this change in the tax law to make sure that we are collecting on what the customer pays and not what the online travel agency pays. First of all, this, as it's been said, the sales tax piece has been corrected for the most part. We are looking at changing it for lodging tax specifically to make sure that they're on equal playing field. Also, we're not the only ones in the discussion. I think that it's been said that there are several states that are dealing with this. There were lawsuits trying to recoup that revenue loss and losing that. Now they're just trying to change the law. So Minnesota is not the only one having these discussions across the country trying to close this loop for destination marketing organizations. Mankato, our Convention and Visitors Bureau, revenue is about 70% lodging tax, so this is a large percentage of our funding. When we look at the STAR report, that's a report that shows out of all the hotels what the occupancy rate is, what the average daily rate is, room demand, all of those statistics. I get that report that shows daily how our community is performing. And based on the revenue that we should have received in lodging tax, we are about $50,000 short. And when I did the math and the research, online travel agencies have about 40% of the bookings, and they're getting about an average 20% commission. So when I did all of that math, it comes up to about $50,000 that is not being collected because of this gap in what the consumer pays and what the online travel agency pays. So that's a large amount. That's 9% of the lodging tax that we should have seen come through our organization. And take that across destination marketing organizations across the state. That is a huge impact in our ability to draw visitors to the state. Mankato concentrates on Iowa, South Dakota, and Wisconsin, trying to drive visitors from out of state here to spend money. And $50,000 for us will go a long way to drive more revenue for the state of Minnesota. And those are the stats I would like to put in front of you today. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Thill. So, Mr. Carlson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. I'm Joel Carlson. I have a legal research and government affairs business here in St. Paul. And I'm here in front of you again on behalf of my client, which is called Travel Tech. And we represent travel agents in Minnesota and across the country. And just so we're clear at the onset, we're not just talking about online companies. When you amended the law in 2011, you created a definition of a accommodation intermediary. And that definition includes anybody who arranges travel. And that was in the tax bill in 2011, as Chair Davids knows. But you also made a new definition for an accommodation provider. An accommodation provider is someone like Marriott that we just heard about that provides their own bookings on their own site. This whole issue doesn't apply to an accommodations provider, period. And that they're exempt right from the statute. But let's go back to what really happened in 2011. In 2011, for the first time, you imposed a sales tax on the service fee that is generated by an accommodation intermediary. And while we weren't very happy about that, we have worked to comply with the statute. And we have done so and continue to do so, but you never changed local lodging tax. You never applied local lodging tax to accommodation intermediary services, period. You would never have made that change. And this problem has, this proposal has a number of problems. And the misperception about how this industry operates is really amazing. It gets a little different every year. But I will tell you this. The hotelier sets the price for the room in every single instance that I'm aware of. The online travel company or any other travel agent never sets the price of the room. The online travel company sells it for the price that the hotelier says. They collect the lodging tax on the full amount that the lodging establishment sets, and there is no tax avoidance. There's no wholesale price of a room. That just doesn't happen. What the online companies do and other travel agents do, without a fee from the hotel, we advertise their sites, we promote their venues, and then we collect a service fee on that. And so let's take this $100. So on the $100 room that we talk about, I think the fee's closer to $10, but the hotelier gets 90 and pays the tax on the 90, and the online travel company gets 10. We pay sales tax on the 10. Bloomington wants us to pay sales tax on the 10 directly to them. So we would become a local taxpayer to all 130 plus local lodging establishments, and their lodging tax is more than the state sales tax. We would be a larger taxpayer to the city of Bloomington than we would be to the state of Minnesota. And to get to your point, Representative Fabian, of what this will do to places like Ballard's, you will have, not them in particular, because I call them directly, but you will have, where you have very low use, you will have online companies and travel intermediaries that will not market properties because they don't want to run the risk of being a taxpayer in that jurisdiction. And if you look on page 110 and you look at the effective date, which has been the same since 2012, since we've been kicking this issue around, they want to confirm that this is the legislature's original intent. And what that means to me is that means you want to make this retroactive so that they can go back and say, you owed us this tax for all of this time when you weren't paying it. And that, I think, is inherently unfair. The second part of that paragraph on 110 says that the local community can find the travel intermediary and tell them how much they owe, and they owe it on December 20th. Our Constitution says in Article 10, Section 1, that if you're going to tax, you have to tax everybody equally and fairly. This is completely unfair. They can find Priceline, and they can leave it at that. They don't have to send a bill to everybody else or even notify them. This is completely unworkable. There isn't a compromise with us and how it is presented in front of you, Mr. Chairman and members. We respectfully say it's just an unworkable proposal that will have a detriment on tourism and utilization in Minnesota, not a benefit. Thank you. I'm happy to answer questions.
Very good. So does the department have any response to any of this at this time? I mean, it's certainly this is an area of concern, and, you know, we're just going to lay this bill over today, but if it, you know, moves further to the general register or whatever, this has to be taken care of. I mean, my intent is not to put something in this bill as it moves forward that is undecided, basically, and it looks like this is, but I don't know if the department wanted to respond at all to this before we kind of, and then I'll come back to you and we'll kind of wrap up here. Ms. Bears.
Mr. Chair, members, with all due respect, we do disagree that this is a tax on service. What happens with a local lodging tax, when, if you compare it to like a buying a book, right? When you go, a customer goes to the store and buys a book, you see one price, you pay the tax on it. You're assuming that you're paying a sales tax on that price that you just purchased it for. What we see is you wouldn't go and ask for the wholesale price to only pay the tax on the wholesale price, saying that the shelving and stocking of it is the service, and you just pay the tax on what the distributor gave to the bookstore. We see this the same way when the online companies, you know, sell these rooms at a rate that may be much higher than what the hotel bargained for with the online travel company. They should be paying it on the price that they sold the customer the hotel room for, not for the price that the wholesaler or the hotel sold it to the online travel company for.
And, okay, so at this time I'm going to ask to see if there's any other folks that would like to speak. So please, we're going to do that. And then I've got Representative Fabian and David's on the list, and then we're going to have to adjourn. So we're not done here with this issue, Mr. Carlson. So thank you. So please proceed. And if anyone else would like to testify, if you would please come down and get ready. So, Ms. Nairn, welcome.
Mr. Chair, I'm sorry. I thought I was registered. My apologies. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Sandy Nairn. I'm with Meserling Kramer, and I'm here today substituting for Mr. Fragnito on behalf of the Minnesota Society of Certified Public Accountants, who have concern about Article 3, mainly Sections 7 and 8, I think, of Article 3 dealing with partnership audits. Over the last 2 years, the AICPA, along with other stakeholders, worked with the Multi-State Tax Commission to develop model language to provide consistency in the state law and clarity for taxpayers and administrators on updating the reporting requirements imposed on taxpayers following a federal audit, as well as to align Minnesota law with the new federal centralized partnership audit regime effective for tax years beginning after January 1st of 2018. That model language is contained in Representative David's House File 1486. We hope this committee will hear that bill soon. That bill is being heard over in the Senate right now, and that's why Mr. Fragnito is not here. House File 2169 selectively incorporates some provisions of the Model Act, but contains major deviations that would impede fair and efficient reporting of federal adjustments. The Society's concerns focus on two issues. The first relates to the statute of limitations sections that Ms. Larson spoke about earlier that would allow the Department of Revenue to assess additional tax after the normal statute of limitations has expired on items not adjusted by the IRS audit, likely imposing double jeopardy on the taxpayer. This provision also would not allow the taxpayer the ability to claim a refund during the same time frame. The Society believes the taxpayer and the department should be on a level playing field. The second issue relates to some impractical requirements for a partnership to identify the residency status and other personal information for all indirect partners. Both of these issues have also been identified in a letter from COST, which was in your packet, and the AICPA, which we just handed out. As this issue moves forward, we look forward to working with the department and the committee to resolve this issue. Thank you for letting me.
Ms. Nairn, thank you so much. So, Representative Fabian, and then Chair Davids, and we'll close.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, as you probably know, I will be calling up to Nick Anthony at Ballard's today, and I know the hotel owners in Roseville, and I'm going to check with them to see what their opinion is on this, and I look forward to having a further discussion on this to make sure that if we do make some changes, that we get it right. We don't need to create confusion in the market and stuff either. So thank you.
Thank you. Chair David.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I don't know, maybe the department or Mr. Carlson. I kind of perked up a little bit. I usually don't read bills, but when I heard about retroactivity, I got a little nervous. Where, maybe Mr. Carlson, where in the bill? I'm on page 110. Is that where do we get the retroactivity comment from?
Mr. Carlson?
Mr. Chairman and members, on page 110, and you look at the effective date starting on 110, line 8, in enacting this section, the legislature confirms that Minnesota Statute 469 and its predecessors and any special laws to impose local lodging taxes were and are intended to apply to the entire consideration paid to obtain access to lodging. And so what that means to me is that you're saying that they were always supposed to be collected, were and are. And that is a huge problem. It has been the same language for several years, and we've testified against it. But to make that crystal clear, I'm almost emotional. I've had people suggest that my clients are tax guffaws and are avoiding taxation. That's the first time I've heard it put that way. I can assure you that I adamantly disagree with that, and every dime of local lodging tax charged by the hotelier gets paid. And that just $400,000 is what I heard on just from one hotel. I adamantly disagree with that, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chairman,
very good.
Yes. Very briefly, and thank you. That's troubling language. That's like bringing a AK-47 when you should have a butter knife here. I mean, were and are intended. That were is a very big word there. And that's a bit frightening. I don't believe this belongs in a policy technical bill, and we've already said we're going to be looking at things. So
absolutely.
I appreciate that, Mr. Chairman.
Yes, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Carlson. Anything from the Department of Revenue? And last thing on this part on the retroactivity. So, Ms. Bears.
Mr. Chair, Representative Davids, this is consistent with what we have in Revenue Notice 1207 that was done in 2012, that this local lodging tax should be collected. And so I think the language is just restating that this is tax that should have already been collected.
So, Ms. Bears, so it would be retroactive to 2012, this tax?
What we're just clarifying is that I'm not sure about the retroactivity, so I will follow up with you about that. But what we're saying is that this is something that they should have already been collecting.
Thank you very much. So we will certainly, be revisiting this before this part would be move forward. I also have some other areas that were under concern. So, Ms. Bears and Department, thank you so much for the presentation. Members, thanks for your indulgence today. And so I will renew my motion to lay over House File 2169 for possible inclusion into the omnibus bill. Members, thank you for your work. Have a good weekend. This committee is adjourned.